We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This episode of the Rock Art Podcast is sponsored by Dr. Renee Vandekar and Dr. Arthur Cushman. Thank you, good doctors, for financially underwriting our effort through the California Rock Art Foundation.
Welcome to the Rock Art Podcast, Episode 1. I'm Chris Webster with Dr. Alan Garfinkel. On today's episode, we're setting the stage by interviewing Dr. Garfinkel himself about his career in archaeology and his interest in rock art. All right, welcome everybody to this brand new podcast. As I said in the introduction, I'm Chris Webster, and welcome Dr. Alan Garfinkel to the podcast. How are you doing?
Chris Webster, I'm just honored to be here, and I'm so excited about our new relationship and launching the Rock Art Podcast. It's a topic that's near and dear to my heart and something that I've really had a passion for most of my adult life.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, you know, you and I have been talking about doing something like this for several years now. And I even had, we were talking about this so long ago that when I had a new sticker run made for the Archaeology Podcast Network, I actually had Rock Art Podcast stickers made up that I still have. And I've just been waiting for the time when I could use those.
That's so hilarious. Oh, Chris, I did not know. Well, I certainly must have one of those for my
my
memorial book, my remembrance volume.
That's right. So, all right. Well, as I said in the intro, we're going to set the stage here because, you know, you're the primary host of this show. You're the expert in rock art. And I want to get our listeners a chance to get to know you before we start interviewing other people. So they kind of know where we're coming from and really what the format of this show is.
Gotcha.
I'm here as the host to kind of facilitate the conversation and really just keep things going. I'm going to ask questions. I'm sitting here learning right along with the listeners. I know as an archaeologist, I know some things about rock art, but I definitely am not an expert in anything in rock art. So, and the other topics we're going to talk about in archaeology that related to that. If at any point in this process that you guys have any questions, you can check the contact info on the show notes for this episode or for this podcast at arcpodnet.com/rockart. And then if there's an episode number, it's /1, for example, for this episode. But you can find us at just arcpodnet.com/rockart. You can also send me an email anytime, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. We'd love to take your questions. I'd love to build up a list of questions and then maybe have a question and answer episode every once in a while. So feel free to send in your questions, comments, or concerns, and we will address those. So Alan, let's start right off the bat from the beginning. How did you get interested in archaeology? And this is ancient history, but when are we talking about here? When in time was this?
I have one of those very unusual backgrounds. I had an anthropology class in high school. It was one of the electives. I had chosen psychology and sociology as option one and option two. Those are both full, and yet they gave me the anthropology class because that was the one that was available. So I had my anthropology class in high school, and I had a very charismatic, wonderful teacher. Her name was Janet Couples. And Janet Couples began to teach me something about this discipline of anthropology. And I was very interested in it, very engaged in it. It was the 1960s, 1970s, and, you know, opened my mind up to all kinds of different things that I'd never really thought about, different cultures, different ways of life. Basically different peoples that were viewing the world a bit differently. And of course, archaeology specifically interested me because of the drama, the detective stories, and the scientific basis. So right after the first couple of weeks of classes, lo and behold, there was a teacher strike. And this teacher strike stopped us sort of in midstream. Well, Janet decided to take some of her students, those that seemed to be the most enthusiastic, and troll them around in her car and bring us all over the planet to allow us to participate in the field of anthropology, archaeology during this time away. And this nice. went on for a couple months. So this was in the San Fernando Valley. This was in Van Nuys, California, James Monroe High School. And we ended up at UCLA on a dig, working out by Malibu. We were at California State University Northridge, helping to catalog artifacts. We went to UCLA in the Archaeological Survey there and helped them in their work. We went to museums. We went to the La Brea Tar Pits and began to volunteer and help them dig up some of the Pleistocene megafauna. On and on and on. And we did this, you know, day in and day out for a couple of months, and I was hooked. I thought this was the best thing since sliced bread.
Most of the time that I've known you, we've always had discussions about rock art, and you've had a, you know, we'll get into all this stuff later, but you've got a, you know, a documentary film regarding rock art, numerous books, you know, and other resources. We've even recorded some videos and stuff that we can link to talking about different aspects of rock art and things related to that. But, you know, I imagine you had other interests. First off, you know, before you found out about rock art, before you first learned about rock art and what it was, but what possibly were some of those earlier interests that first piqued your interest in archaeology and the study of archaeology in the past?
Well, when I went to college, I went to California State University Northridge. It used to be called San Fernando Valley State College. It was just at the very beginning of the environmental law. It was when the National Environmental Policy Act was passed, and they passed a comparable or twin law for California called the California Environmental Quality Act. This was during the renaissance of the environmental movement when they had that big, huge oil spill off the coast. And people were now developers, builders, people with various initiatives had to find some way to deal with archaeology, historic preservation. And as a new student at the university, we decided that there was a house that the university owned. They were willing to give it to us. We made a museum out of the house, and we began to call ourselves archaeologists and get paid to do environmental compliance. Hmm. Right from the get-go, I was paid to go out and look for archaeological sites and to write reports to clear projects, which was remarkable.
Yeah. So it's hard to get paid for that now.
Right. So timing is everything. And we started the Northridge Archaeological Research Center. Since it was the 60s, the acronym stands for NARC. Now, only a few of us would know what that means, but in any event, that's what we did. And we were crazy kids and we're having a blast. We were going around and doing archaeology and being paid for it and taking courses and learning and earning at the same time. It was fabulous.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Where did that lead? Because obviously that that organization doesn't exist anymore. So where did you go from there?
Well, believe it or not, we had heard that the California Department of Transportation from time to time had contracts that when they developed a particular highway, a road that would damage or impact or disturb, in some sense, destroy a significant archaeological site, they had to contract with the university and excavate those sites, preserve that information, and do something by way of publishing and learning more about the past. So I spent a summer developing a research design, and we won the contract, and we began doing contract archaeology for the California Department of Transportation. That was that first summer.
Wow. Okay.
And so that was in Santa Barbara County, a place called Cuyama, and that was still in the salvage archaeology days. And so we had a blast. We worked on an agave roasting pit, a huge oven site where they would acquire the yucca whippoli, our Spanish bayonet, and roast it. And the entire site was full of fire-cracked rock. And the other site was one that was a village site. And one of our test units went down, I believe it was 3 or 4 meters, to about 7, 8, 9,000 years ago.
Jeez. Okay.
So that was sort of my seminal, my beginning sort of teasing actions on trying to understand archaeology and the nature of the discipline. So I had a taste of contract archaeology, environmental compliance, and also the academic side. So I've always had many different elements or manifestations of the discipline going simultaneously. So no matter what I was doing, I was always writing and publishing and doing research designs and putting things together almost from the very start, the very, very start. And so I guess my passion has always been in the scientific side, but also trying to probe the past and understand a bit more about the nature of humanity, the indigenous perspective, Native Americans, and what they think, how they know, what their religion is like, what's their worldview, and what were they doing at these particular places.
Sure. Hey, let's step back real quick to the DOT project, really Caltrans project probably. And I'm curious about the time frame on that, because actually I'm also the host of the CRM Archaeology podcast, if anybody's heard of that that's listening to this. And we just interviewed Tom King, who is one of the early figures in archaeology that was helping to basically helping write the National Environmental Policy Act and some amendments to that. And then this thing called National Register Bulletin 38, him and his wife helped write that, that helps with the National Park Service. And he was a California archaeologist. And I'm just thinking about the time frame. So the National Historic Preservation Act was 1966. NEPA came along in the 70s. And it's curious to me that the DOT or Caltrans was contracting with the university. I'm curious, do you know if that was in response to one of those two regulations or acts, or if it was more the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, because I don't actually know when CEQA came about. Was that before all that or after
CEQA
all that?
CEQA was just immediately after that in the mid okay. to early 1970s. But it's interesting because Tom King and Michael Morato were the pivotal figures behind the public archaeology, the National Historic Preservation Act, the California Environmental Quality Act, all in California, putting up the information centers and basically allowing archaeology to be perceived as a significant resource. And so I knew them in this heyday, worked with Tom King, and he was aware of me, and also knew Mike from that very early period. And so we were kind of intertwined in this stew that was incubating and hatching of people who were building the new profession of cultural resource management and public archaeology.
Nice, nice, man. It's amazing how much happened in the 70s and in that time frame that helped build everything that we're building on today, not just in California, primarily in California. A lot of this was developed in California and then spread across the country, but you know, other areas of the country actually had their own genesis, so to speak, locally of different regulations and things like that. So, man, it was amazing. Amazing time to be around, I'm sure, because things were probably changing relatively rapidly on the regulatory front, not so much on the archaeology front, but on the regulatory front. So
well, yeah, and we were pioneering a lot of new ways of thinking about things and doing things. So after I got my bachelor's degree, I tried to find a way to then do my advanced degree. I knew I wanted to get a master's or a PhD, mostly a PhD. And so I applied to a number of universities and nobody accepted me. So that's the good news and the bad news. So I figured I had heard that this wasn't an uncommon thing. So I decided that I could go to Riverside, California, in Southern California, and live there near the University of California, Riverside, and basically take classes for no credit and sort of begin to, you know, sort of test the waters, as it were, and get a hand in on the discipline. Well, people had been doing that too often, so they changed the rules just as I was trying to accomplish that. So I left my home, moved to Riverside, and lived in a house, a two-story Victorian, filled with archaeological women. There was all kinds of the ladies of archaeology, as it were. And nice. I was the only man there, and I found myself in Riverside. And so I shared that with my colleagues and close friends. And they said, well, don't worry. If you can't get into UC Riverside, just go over to the Bureau of Land Management and they'll hire you. So I went and talked with Rick Hanks and Eric Ritter. And they said, sure, we need you. Why don't you know, we'll put you on as a junior archaeologist and you can get going. We're doing this thing called the Desert Planning Staff. And you start on Monday.
Nice.
That's what happened there. Literally, I'm not exaggerating. That's exactly what happened.
That's awesome.
A different world. Okay.
All right. Well, on that note, let's take a break and we will come back and pick this story up on the other side. Back in a second.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code ROCKART. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to episode one of the brand new Rock Art podcast from the Archaeology Podcast Network. And I'm here with Dr. Garfinkel, and we are talking about his history. So, hey, you just got your job at the BLM. Where do you go from there? What did you do with the BLM? First off, where at the BLM were you? Because there's BLM district offices all over the place. So did they send you around or were you in a specific location?
So the BLM is the Bureau of Land Management, for those that may not know. And
thank you.
They are the entity that manages what we call public lands. Well, government lands are all over the country, but they are very, very commonly in areas that are underdeveloped. And as it turns out, in Riverside, there were two archaeologists that were contracted. They worked full time there, as I did too, to do what's called the Desert Planning Staff. So the Bureau of Land Management at that point had decided that they needed to plan and understand the resource base of the entire California desert. If you can imagine that.
Okay.
The California desert is absolutely huge, and the BLM owns and manages much of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our job. to figure out some way to know what exists by way of archaeology, cultural resources, significant treasures of the past in the entire California desert. So
that's all.
Yeah, that's all. So they took it in pieces, and the first piece that they began to do work in was in the Western Mojave Desert, out in the El Paso Mountains and near the area of Walker Pass and near the area just north of Mojave and out into the Eastern Kern Inyo Mono region of California. Mm-hmm. Well, my first job was to take all the USGS topographic maps and copy them with all of the archaeological sites identified upon them, so we could have an inventory of the USGS topographic maps with all the cultural resources that exist throughout California. So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Then we had to visit them. So we began visiting them and looking and trying to understand which areas had the most cool stuff. Well, we also contracted with a gentleman who had visited rock art sites all over California. Mm-hmm. And he had a inventory, a photographic inventory of these rock art sites. And we purchased, wow, we purchased that from him. His name was Ike Eastvold. And Ike Eastvold would go to these sites and stay there and sleep there and photograph them. And, you know, this was a early on. And so his archive was one of the few that was available at that time. And so we said, well, we got this archive. Let's go visit all these sites. So the first sites I went to see with my colleagues were the prominent rock art sites throughout California, and mostly in mm-hmm. the California desert. That included Fossil Falls and Little Lake. It included the Coso Rock Art. It included areas called Black Canyon and Cow Cove and all these sites all over California, Colorado Desert, Mojave Desert, everywhere and anywhere. And I began to see them and visit them and said, you know what, fellas, these are really cool. These sites are really, really cool. And I think I really like them. I was over the moon about them.
Yeah.
I said, come on. There's pictures that are preserved on rocks for thousands of years. How can that be? I mean, come on. So a lot of them were on basalt lava flows. Some of those were in the canyons near Tenaja's, big, huge water tanks that preserve water and have water in the desert for quite a while after the winter rains. A lot of pictures mm-hmm. of bighorn sheep and animal human figures and people using otlatls, which are their equipment to use to throw darts at animals, bows and arrows, and what have you. We also saw painting sites near springs in the western Mojave in the far Southern Sierras. And we just kept doing this all over the mm-hmm. California desert. I went to Palm Springs. I went to Hole in the Wall out in the eastern Mojave, the Mid Hills, the Providence Range. Where else did I go? Everywhere and anywhere. I did that for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing.
Were all these big, famous rock art sites that people familiar with California archaeology, I mean, we've just heard about these sites, time and time again. In that time frame, in the 1970s, I mean, were these well-known sites back then too? Had they been discovered many, many years before? I mean, obviously Native Americans have known about them for centuries, but as far as Western discoveries and so-called modern science, were those relatively unresearched? And I guess that's a separate question from how long ago were they discovered?
Yeah, I would say most of them were not well-known, poorly known, and not well recognized, not well researched, and really not publicized in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So only people who had an interest in them, who would have, gone the extra mile to research them through the archaeological community or through some sort of museum, would they then have access and knowledge to their precise locations. Many of them are far off the beaten track. Difficult to find, difficult to get to, sometimes mm-hmm. very remote, and other times just difficult to know where precisely they are. Even to this very day, there's some of the people called rock art explorers, and mm-hmm. what they do is they have a passion to find and locate and visit and photograph these remarkable sites. And they have to, through sort of this, what would you call it? Sort of this this connection of avocationalists, they learn little details, little clues. It's like a detective plan, and they've got to then see if they can find out enough information precisely to locate them. Some of them are very, very difficult to find or very, very difficult to access. Even if you know their location, to get there, you need to be a class A1 hiker.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the first time that you took myself and our crew up to the Little Petroglyph Canyon at China Lake Naval Weapons Center. I mean, first off, it's on a hyper secure military installation, so nobody's going there unless they want you to. But even if that weren't the case, if you didn't know where it was and there wasn't like a road that leads you there, I mean, you drive right past it or hike right past it. I mean, this is one of the most dense collections of rock art in the Western Hemisphere. And if you didn't know where it was, you wouldn't be able to find it.
Yeah.
It's so remote.
and what's interesting about that particular location, and I've only become to really understand this recently, is that one of the reasons you can't see it is it's subterranean. In other words, you've got the surface of the ground there in the valley floor, and then you have this canyon that's dissected or sort of ingrained and ensconced into there, and it goes deeper and deeper and descends off and it flows out of that basalt flow. And so you really can't see it unless you're on top of it.
Right. It's crazy.
And that may have been one of the reasons it was so significant to the native people, because there is this association with the underworld, the animal underworld. And this is a place where the animals lived, or after they passed away and became animal spirits and were transformed back into living beings. See, the animals to the native people in part were immortal. And it was the responsibility of the animal master who lived in the underworld to transform them from spirit animals back to authentic living animals. And this happened every spring.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So what we're seeing sometimes in these descending canyons, these obscure hidden places, is sort of a three-dimensional model of the cosmology, the worldview, the belief system, the religious precepts of native people are emblazoned on the rocks. They're telling you a story. We can't really understand it sometimes because it's rather abstract. But as you study cross-culturally throughout the world, understand the religious precepts, the cosmology, the nature of how native people understand the world, you begin to ask better and better questions and perceive, at least superficially, what some of these images mean. So that's exciting. It's sort of a discovery. It's a detective game. And it's something that, in turn, is endlessly engaging and continues for me in terms of fulfilling my passion to understand. It links the study of religion with the study of science. It links art history. It also links our understanding of things like prehistoric population movements or the changing nature of land use patterns and subsistence patterns. In other words, what people ate, where did they live, where did they move, who lived there, and what did they believe and what did they understand and what did they value? What was the significance of commemorating their lives through images?
Right. Okay. Well, this leads to so many more questions that I have, but we're going to get to all that possibly even in a later episode, because we're going to bring all these themes back as we're bringing on guests and having more discussions about these things. But let's jump back to your life in archaeology. And because one thing, I'm glad we had this sort of aside to where you're at now, what you're thinking now, and the questions you're interested in, because, you know, the average person who's not in, say, a scientific field or even archaeology for that matter, might look at this and say, well, this is totally beyond me. How does somebody go from, you know, where I'm at right now to thinking about these types of questions and having these types of concerns? It doesn't happen overnight. It happens through years and decades of study and thought and just really immersing yourself in this stuff. So let's go back to, you know, after your year at the BLM and your exposure to these fantastic rock art sites that we knew little about, that we know not a whole lot more about now, to be honest. Rock art is very difficult to interpret. So, but we'll get into that later. So what happened after your year at the BLM? Where did you go from there? Now that you've got this interest in rock art, did that develop from there? Or did you go another direction or take you a little while to get there?
I was still obsessed with getting a graduate degree. And so
sure.
as it turned out, I continued to send applications and I was accepted into the PhD program at the University of California, Davis. And so I ended up moving to Davis and proceeding forward in that particular program. I had a number of peers that were in that program at the same time. And all of those people became some of the most significant figures in California archaeology. They were the people that are the principals of some consulting companies that do some of the most exemplary archaeological work in all of California,
mm-hmm.
and even into the Great Basin and throughout the country and around the world. So we had some remarkable people, professors teaching at UC Davis, including Professor Martin Baumhoff, who is known for his expertise in California ethnology, and Dr. D.L. True, who pioneered a lot of the understanding of the far Southern California archaeological research. So I came in there and had much more experience in archaeology than most of my colleagues, most of my peers. So as it turned out, what happened was I continued to work in the contract archaeology and the public archaeology game at the same time as continuing my studies. So I was working in the field and I was also proceeding to get my degree. And at about that time, another opportunity came my way and they said, "Hey, we heard from the Bureau of Land Management again, this time at the BLM office, the Bureau of Land Management in Bakersfield. They need someone to do an internship." And I said, "Oh, that's interesting." Says, "Is it paid?" "Yes, they'll pay you. You'll be an employee." But you'll have to live in Bakersfield. I said, "Okay, I'm signed on. Let's go."
Yeah.
So I moved to Bakersfield, lived for a time with the Bakersfield archaeologist, and then found myself doing the first cultural resource management plan for the Little Lake Fossil Falls District. So in other words, wow. We had another amazing area which is world-class rock art in an area that's just extraordinary, solid archaeology. And the Bureau of Land Management owned it and had to find some way to protect it, interpret it, and somehow manage these treasures of cultural resources. So that's what I did for another 6 months or a year. I lived at the Little Lake Hotel at Little Lake, which was a 1930s era hotel. I spent the day wandering around Fossil Falls and trying to inventory what was there, getting lost in the maze of the lava flows there, which are just an absolute, you know, littered. And the entire area is one solid archaeological site. So I had to segment things. Fossil Falls is an area where the Pleistocene Owens River, 12,000 years ago, carved a gorge out of the lava flows of the Coso Range and drops a couple hundred feet onto the valley floor, and has a few archaeological sites and tremendous amounts of rock art right there. And so I was being paid to do this plan, and as it turned out, they eventually published it. So I did the cultural resource management plan for the Fossil Falls Little Lake District, and I put them on the National Register.
Nice. Wow. That's a lot for an internship. That's great.
And then my committee, my PhD committee said, "Oh yeah, by the way, you can use that document as your master's thesis."
Nice. Nice.
So I got my master's done. I got paid for it. And I did some good to protect the rock art, archaeology, and magnificent prehistoric treasures of this area.
Well, what a great point to take our final break and come back and wrap up this discussion about your career and where we're at now. So we'll be back in a minute.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our TeePublic store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, Episode 1. I'm Chris Webster, and I've got, of course, Dr. Alan Garfinkel with me today. And we are just setting the stage for this fantastic Rock Art Podcast that we're going to do. And we're talking about Dr. Garfinkel's career in archaeology and study of rock art. And you just got your master's. So how do you top that? What'd you do for your PhD?
Well, same thing. You know, you talk about getting paid for doing your PhD. Well, as it turns out, a number of my peers got together and we started the Far Western Anthropological Research Group out in Davis. Mm-hmm. And I systematically began to obtain contracts for them to make them a profitable organization. We did the first contract in the Western Mojave Desert in the El Paso Mountains, doing an excavation at some open air campsites that were filled with bunny bones. They were harvesting the rabbits, the lagomorphs, both the jackrabbits and the cottontails, using probably a communal rabbit drives. And that was there. And then we began doing the archaeological work for the Pacific Crest Trail, which was going in north of Walker Pass and moving along. And so we had a series of contracts to do the work there, working from Walker Pass, moving north, and also moving to the south. And so as we began to excavate and study all of those sites, that became the basis of my PhD dissertation. There was 7 different projects, and I synthesized those and put that all together and then developed a plan and used that for my PhD dissertation, which was about linguistic prehistory. It was also about rock art. And So we began to try to understand or tease out the antiquity, the nature of the various ethnic groups that existed in this small area of Eastern California. We had the group called the Tobotalabal. Say that fast 6 times. Tobotalabal means pinyon pine nut eaters that lived on the South Fork of the Kern Plateau. And they were up in that particular area, the high elevations of the far Southern Sierras. Then to the south, we had the Kawayasu, lived in the Tehachapi Mountains on the Western Mojave Desert. And then just to the north, we had what's called the Panamint Shoshone or the Timbisha Shoshone or Timbisha. And so we had 3 different ethnolinguistic groups, tribal groups, all packed in there. And so if we began to study the archaeology, what we could discover is that the archaeological record mirrored or provided a signature of each of those ethnic groups. We could differentiate who they were linguistically and find that the physical remains, the prehistoric archaeological remains, were different, the artifacts, and also their rock art was different. And if you looked at the archaeology and the rock art and identified its antiquity, you can compare that with what the linguists said, the people who study the historical linguistics and the genetic relationships between languages, and talk about the time depth of those people and see how that mirrored or did not mirror, either it supported or refuted, the models relating to the nature of the land use patterns, prehistoric population replacements, in migrations, etc. And so that was the basis of my PhD dissertation. And that was ultimately published by the Matarengo Museum, and it became my PhD dissertation for the University of California, Davis, when I received my PhD.
Okay. Well, that's great. And I think we've definitely alluded to this, and you talked about helping to found Far Western, which is still an ongoing major powerhouse in Western and California archaeology. I mean, they are stacked with people doing research, and not just cultural resources management, which we haven't really talked about too much. For people that are listening to this podcast that might not be, of course, professional archaeologists and understand what that is, this is, as we discussed regulations early on in your career, this is archaeology cultural resources management, I should say, not just archaeology. Archaeology is a part of it, but that's mandated by regulation, sometimes federal, sometimes state, sometimes a combination of the two. Far Western was set up to address those types of contracts and those types of projects, as were a number of other organizations and companies during that time frame. So,
as you're well aware, and I'm sure you've said this and shared this on the Archaeology Podcast Network, most of the archaeology being done throughout America is cultural resource management. It's all funded by compliance work, either by private or public or governmental entities.
Right.
And California alone is I'd say the richest, or one of the largest in the world in terms of full-time employment and the revenue of various entities conducting cultural resource studies. It's remarkable. There's over 2,000 professionals that do cultural resource management in California. And just if we look at a very small part of it, even in one naval base alone in China Lake, they have a budget of $3 million a year just to do the cultural resources work.
So you can imagine.
And yeah, I'm sure it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars each year, minimum.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons California is so prolific with that is, I mean, not only just the density, the archaeological record in that state, but also the regulations. So the California Environmental Quality Act, or what we call CEQA, that we mentioned before, really in a lot of ways goes above and beyond federal regulations and really, really dives in. So, you can't drop a spoon in the ground in California without having to, have cultural resources done first.
It's been a blessing and a curse, because it's been a blessing to archaeologists and academicians. It's a curse to developers and other land management agencies. But at the same time, there's contracts that are let by various land management agencies, including the Bureau of Land Management, National Park Service. You can talk about Caltrans, et cetera. And what they do is they try to inventory or manage and find some way to preserve and conserve their resources.
Yeah, indeed. So let's talk about some more directions that you went in CRM, because when we met, well, it was just not long before we started working together on a contract at China Lake. So you were working for a firm that was doing cultural resource management at the time, and you had a pretty extensive career in cultural resources management. So let's talk about that. After Far Western, where did you go from there?
It's funny, because I began to work almost from the get-go, initially as almost they call it a permanent intermittent. Talk about an oxymoron. I had a permanent intermittent position with Caltrans and finally went permanent. And I continued to work there for 9 years, the first stint. And then I took a powder and then came back again for another 9 years working for Caltrans. And so working for Caltrans as an archaeologist, they had an enormous program all over the state, and I helped them pioneer that. They had districts all over California. They have tremendous amounts of resources. I think they had 30 or 40 full-time professionals in cultural resource management when I worked there. Some unbelievable number. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things I did, was I continued to work there for Caltrans and was involved with... Always, I had the esoteric projects, the ones that weren't sort of conventional. I would be publishing books and articles and doing public relations and having slideshows and all kinds of crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. So, but I learned how to do public archaeology for the government. That's what that particular job taught me.
So that is a great segue, because we're nearly done with this podcast episode for episode one here, because I mean, your career is extensive enough and we can make a whole series just on talking about the stuff that you've done. So I'm sure more of this will come up over time as we do these other interviews and we talk to other people. But for now, I want to shift gears a little bit to the public archaeology aspect of things. What are some of the I will link to some of these in the show notes as well, but what are some of the resources that you've been a part of or helped put together that people can find and that we can link to so they can learn more about rock art and things that you've done and have been interested in?
Well, about 6 or 7 years ago, I decided that there's a lot of organizations throughout California that are interested in rock art, are interested in archaeology, but nothing as an overarching entity. So I started what's called the California Rock Art Foundation, which is focused on being a 501c3 not-for-profit educational and scientific organization that focuses on conservation, documentation, heritage preservation, and public outreach, working with Native Americans, working with organizations, and trying to preserve, interpret, and educate the public about the value of rock art. And so that has been a passion for me in that department. In terms of my own academic background, I post much of my research that's been published, both books and articles, on academia.edu under the title of Alan Garfinkel. The California Rock Art Foundation has its own website as well. And then I'm on Facebook and YouTube as well.
Let's talk about the documentary film you have put together.
So I think it was about 7 years ago, I got a bee in my bonnet and decided that if I was going to really educate the general public and really show the value and merit and meaning of rock art, the best way to do that, the best platform to communicate that information would be a documentary film, a film of some sort. So I had a few false starts, and I could never find someone who was interested in that. So I tried a variety of people who represented themselves as cinematographers or videographers, but we never really launched. So just like you and I were talking about before, when we have a grand obsession, we just keep pressing forward.
And That's right.
We don't take no for an answer, and we just, you know, keep the vision and keep looking for the opening. When the front door is locked and bolted, we go through the window. And so
that's right.
So I kept thinking about this, and I said, you know what? When I was doing my graduate work and getting my PhD, I remember I met a guy by the name of David Hurst Thomas, and I think he's got a highfalutin job at the American Museum of Natural History now. And they hired him on right out of grad school. He knows me. I know him. He'll take my phone call. I'm going to call him and ask him, you know, who he'd recommend to make a documentary film for me. So I call him one day. He said, oh, Alan, how are you? He says, I'm fine, Dave. How are you? I said, can you help me? He says, what do you need? He says, I need to find someone who's going to help me make a film about Coso rock art. He says, well, interestingly enough, I've got the guy for you right here in my office. And his name is Paul Goldsmith. He's won Emmys and Oscars, and he does cinematography and absolutely does engaging, wonderful, award-winning documentary films. I go, okay, yeah, let me speak to him.
Nice.
So I talked to him, and he said, well, that's all well and good, Alan, but let's explore this. Take me somewhere and show me some of this Coso rock art you're talking about. So I met him at Little Lake, and he stayed there overnight, and he took some shots, and he said, you know, this has some legs. We could possibly make this into a movie. Says, okay, well, what is it going to take? Says, we need $10,000. Says, $10,000. Says, that's not a problem. I'm independently wealthy. You know that, Paul. And so I'll get you that check next week. So I had absolutely no idea how I was going to get $10,000. But at the time, I was working for what they call the the multi-hundred pound gorilla of cultural resource management, the engineering firm, the apex predator, thing called AECOM. And AECOM is a multi-billion dollar company, world company, with, you know, how much, let's say, $20 billion in revenue a year. And they're in over 100 countries throughout the world. And so I talked to the public relations director and I said, well, I'm trying to do a movie and, you know, it's going to really help AECOM. It can talk about sustainability and other things. And we've got world-class rock art. He says, what do you need? I said, I need a check for $10,000. He says, well, I can get you that. So we talked to the CEO and they cut me a check.
Nice. Nice.
And so I got the 10K check and we were off and running. 4 years later, we completed the film.
That's crazy. 4 years.
4 years.
Jeez.
It is available through the Bradshaw Foundation as an ebook. It's also available domestically in the United States through a documentary educational resources. It's called Talking Stone, and it's been on PBS, and every once in a while they show it. And my cinematographer actually, besides doing the film, did a book. So you've seen the film, read the book.
Yeah.
And the book is a, you know, coffee table book with gorgeous pictures and tells the story of the movie and has some just engaging, just beautiful eye candy from our efforts. And it's been a win for all of us.
Awesome. Well, we will have links to that in the show notes. I've seen the film. In fact, it's a, you know, I've got the DVD, it's on my bookshelf, and it's really great and gives you a great understanding of, or at least an introduction into, you know, Coso rock art and that whole area of California. It's just phenomenal what's out there. So take a look at that in the show notes. And that's about all we have time for this episode, but I'm sure we will get to know Alan better through the future interviews we're going to have and everything we have coming up. So check back weekly for this podcast. As we like to do with the Archaeology Podcast Network, when we release a new show, we usually release two episodes on the release date. So be sure to find episode 2. Should have downloaded right when this one downloaded. So find episode 2. Maybe you listen to episode 2 first. I don't know. We also have an episode 0 we like to call it, but most of the outlets make us call it episode 1. That's just a little introductory episode. You can use that to share with your family and friends. And that is the last ask here. Share this out with your family and friends and people you think might be interested in history and rock art and archaeology and all things of the past. So check that out. And we will be back next time. If you listen to this one first, there's another episode waiting for you right now, but we'll be back weekly after that with another great episode about rock art, archaeology, and the past. So thanks for listening. And thank you, Dr. Garfinkel, for this first episode.
Adios, amigos.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. You can find this podcast on the educational podcast app Lyceum, L-Y-C-E-U-M, and wherever you find podcasts. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.